I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, President Trump threatens to use the Insurrection Act in Minnesota, what that means for protesters on the ground. A razor-thin vote blocks the effort to limit the president's war powers in Venezuela, the one thing the administration promised in order to get Republicans to change their minds.
I am Magdalena Volinskaridi, and I'm here outside the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, where the new mosaic portrait of the Pope will be installed.
These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of St. Paul the First Hermit. Our top story tonight, the Trump administration defends the president's threat to use the Insurrection Act. He wants to end violent protests in Minneapolis where ICE agents are targeting illegal immigrants. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Veronica, the Insurrection Act dates back to 1807. Now the president could use it to deploy troops to quell protests, despite opposition from Democrats.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem tells EWTN what she believes it will take to end the violence in Minnesota.
It'll take law and order and leadership there that partners with us that we haven't seen yet.
Noem also responded to President Donald Trump's threat to invoke the Insurrection Act. He wrote, if the corrupt politicians of Minnesota don't obey the law and stop the professional agitators and insurrectionists from attacking the patriots of ICE, who are only trying to do their job, I will institute the Insurrection Act, which many presidents have done before me, and quickly put an end to the travesty that is taking place in that once great state.
Oh, I think that the president has that opportunity in the future. It's his constitutional right, and it's up to him if he wants to utilize it.
Do you think he's likely to do it?
I don't know.
The president's warning came after another incident with an ICE agent in Minneapolis, when, according to federal officials, the agent shot and wounded a man who had attacked the officer with a shovel or broom handle.
We cannot counter Donald Trump's chaos with our own brand of chaos. For those that have peacefully protested, I applaud you. For those that are taking the bait, you are not helping.
The White House press secretary calling for the violence to stop.
But I would ask that the governor stops inciting the harassment and illegal obstruction of law enforcement in his state. All ICE and federal law enforcement are trying to do are remove people like this off of the streets of Governor Walz's city in Minneapolis and of his state in Minnesota.
Democrats say President Trump has threatened to use the Insurrection Act before.
You never know what is true with regards to the president's threats. However, he has carried out some unconstitutional acts consistently over the past year.
And on social media today, Minnesota's governor made a direct appeal to President Trump, saying, let's turn the temperature down. And he told the people of Minnesota, quote, we cannot fan the flames of chaos. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
President Trump is calling on Congress to enact the Great Healthcare Plan. It's a sweeping proposal to slash drug prices and insurance premiums while demanding total price transparency. A major part of the plan involves redirecting billions of taxpayer subsidies away from big insurance companies and instead giving them directly to eligible Americans. The plan requires any provider accepting Medicare or Medicaid to prominently post their fees at their place of business. It also pushes for more safe pharmaceutical drugs to be available over the counter to reduce costly doctor visits.
The government is going to pay the money directly to you. It goes to you, and then you take the money and buy your own health care. Nobody's ever heard of that before, and that's the way it is. The big insurance companies lose, and the people of our country win.
A historic day at the White House as President Trump meets with Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. The visit marks their first in-person meeting since the U.S. arrested Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. After discussing Venezuela's future, the Nobel Peace Prize winner declined to answer questions regarding Trump's doubts about her leadership. So far, President Trump has signaled a willingness to work with acting President Delcy Rodriguez. Following today's meeting, Machado gave brief remarks to the media and supporters, saying that Venezuelans are counting on President Trump for the freedom of their country. U.S. forces have seized another fugitive oil tanker linked to the Venezuelan to Venezuela in the Caribbean. Marines launched from USS Gerald R. Ford to board the oil tanker named the Veronica. It was intercepted after authorities say it defied a strict quarantine. The Department of Homeland Security released dramatic footage of U.S. forces taking control of the deck. The U.S. has now seized six oil tankers since ramping up a campaign against illicit oil trade by Venezuela. Currently, any oil leaving the region must now pass through U.S. sanctioned channels. Senate Republicans have blocked an effort to curb the Trump administration's military actions in Venezuela. The measure would have mandated congressional approval for launching any further military action in the country. But with the vice president's tie-breaking vote, it failed. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Veronica. The resolution's defeat came less than a week after five Republicans broke ranks with their party and joined Democrats to bring the measure to the floor. However, two senators later withdrew their support after receiving phone calls from President Trump. Senator Josh Hawley was one of those who switched his vote.
The secretary also told me directly that the administration will not put ground troops into Venezuela. They do not seek to occupy Venezuela. But his commitment to abide by the War Powers Notification procedures and also the Constitution is directly responsive to my concerns. So I'm inclined to take yes for an answer.
Democrat Senator Tim Kaine, the chief author of the resolution, blasted Republicans for not showing any backbone to President Trump.
It's disappointing that my colleagues let the president sort of beat him into submission. I mean, after they voted last week to basically say, this is an important enough issue to discuss in front of the American public, as the Constitution requires, the White House put a full court press on, unlike any I've seen in 13 years here.
What has happened tonight is a roadmap to another endless war, because this Senate, under Republican leadership, failed to assert its legitimate and needed authority.
Republicans say they back the president.
Boots on the ground, for the most part, is off the table. I think when you want to talk about a large-scale ground commitment, that is something that we have to reassert congressional involvement in.
What would you like to see for Venezuela in the future?
This should be about democracy. Maduro gone is great news, but the first thing we should have said is, how do we set up free and open elections? How do we help them get through these difficult times?
And many believe Maria Machado should be in charge.
She, along many other members of the opposition, will be able to put that electoral system back in place and create an environment for free and fair elections with international observers and with the help and support of the United States.
Machado spent the afternoon with lawmakers on Capitol Hill after meeting the president this morning. Before the meeting, she was handed a rosary from a Senate staffer who says she fled Venezuela at the age of 9, but wouldn't give her name. Machado immediately put the rosary around her neck and wore it during the meeting with lawmakers. Although it failed in the Senate, next week the House plans to take up its own war powers resolution. This as President Trump continues to raise the prospect of military force in other parts of the world, like Iran and Greenland. Senate Democrats say that they plan to have additional war power votes in the future. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
In Syria, government forces have issued an evacuation order ahead of an anticipated offensive against Kurdish-led forces. Residents in Aleppo attempted to flee through a humanitarian corridor opened on the front lines. Intense battles between the Syrian military and armed groups are escalating. The fighting broke out after negotiations stalled between Damascus and the SDF over an agreement to integrate their forces. Joining me now is Nadine Meenza, former chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Nadine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us an overview of what's happening in northeast Syria right now?
Sure. The Syrian government has amassed troops and heavy equipment along the border of northeast Syria, just west of the Euphrates, kind of between Aleppo and Raqqa, basically. And Damascus has announced a new military operation, and some initial attacks have already begun. So the Kurdish-run region and the Syrian Democratic Forces, who, of course, were partnered with the U.S. in the defeat of the ISIS caliphate, we've given them a lot of credit for what they've done in making it a safe society, but also what they did that's most unknown is that they, and certainly rare in Syria, is they set up and created a society that's inclusive, where Christians, Yazidis, and other minorities are equal citizens and also part of government. In fact, half of their leaders are actually women. And so all these gains in building this cohesive society are at risk with this invasion.
How strong is ISIS?
And that's the other point. ISIS is rising. So, of course, ISIS was very weak before this Syrian government took over, but the chaos of the transition. And, of course, the Syrian security forces have been implicated in massacres against the Alawites in March, against the Druze in July. And then there was a bombing from extremists, a suicide bomber against Mar Ellis Church in June in Damascus that killed 30 Christians and injured 54. You know, we see a lot of security forces with the Syrian government that wear ISIS patches on their uniform. And in fact, in December, an insider attack from a Syrian security force member who was working with the U.S. government killed two U.S. soldiers and a U.S. translator.
Now, you did mention that church bombing, but additionally, how are the Yazidis and Christians being impacted?
Yeah, they're they're scared of these security forces, and that is what's different about the Northeast. In the Northeast, the leaders of the government are actually people from their own communities. So you'll see Yazidis and Christians in major official roles throughout every level of government. In fact, it's a tapestry of all the religious communities because it's such a diverse part of Syria.
You're also spending time in D.C. to brief members of Congress. What recommendations are you making?
Well, I think the most important one at this moment is that this impending attack is actually a violation of the bill that they just passed in December to lift Caesar sanctions on Syria. The Caesar sanctions are country government destroying sanctions that were lifted to give the people of Syria a chance. But they also listed after in the bill saying you need to take care of religious minorities. You also need tangible and credible steps to implement the March 10th agreement, or they should have new sanctions.
Nadine Manza, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
A new rule just passed by the Department of Homeland Security eases visa restrictions for religious workers. Priests, nuns, and other religious workers are now able to return to the U.S. without waiting a full year abroad after reaching their five-year visa limit. DHS says the change protects religious freedom and prevents disruptions to essential ministry services. The change takes effect immediately. To discuss this further, we're happy to welcome Ashley Feasley, legal expert in residence at the Immigration Law and Policy Initiative at Catholic University School of Law. Ashley, thank you so much for coming on today. Now, this change will have a major effect for the church and the faithful. Can you tell us more about the impact this will have on parishes across the country?
So there is traditionally sometimes a shortage of religious workers, particularly deacons and priests. And many times it's difficult for them to renew their visa. They had before had to leave the country for up to a year. This enables them to renew their visa in a very short time, sometimes just the length of what it takes to do the actual consular visit. It'll help ensure continuity of community and, you know, diocesan support in an important way.
Do you happen to know how long this has been going on for, and if the USCCB, if they were able to engage with the Trump administration to have these rules changed?
So the USCCB has long been an advocate to support easing the ability for religious workers to be able to serve in the United States. And they have worked with a variety of administrations, both legislatively and administratively. So I do know that they continue that work tirelessly and bipartisanly, both with Congress, this president administration, and prior ones.
What will priests, nuns, and religious workers have to do now after reaching that five-year mark on their visa?
So it's really important to understand that the immigration law does treat what we describe as ministerial workers, so priests and deacons, differently than our brothers and sisters. And this applies specifically to the priests and deacons. It enables them to renew that visa, like I said, with less kind of administrative detail and without having to have that year outside of the country. This will enable them to be able to hopefully serve in a more continuous manner and to ease some of the, you know, the backlogs that we've been seeing on this issue in dioceses and parishes regularly.
So it will certainly make a big impact across the nation. Ashley Feasley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Four NASA astronauts are back on Earth after the SpaceX Dragon capsule splashed down safely just off the coast of California in San Diego earlier today. This marks NASA's first medical evacuation. The astronauts had to return about a month early from the International Space Station because of a medical situation with one of the crew members on board. NASA says that astronaut is being evaluated at the hospital. As for the other astronauts, they will spend the night at a San Diego hospital before flying to Houston. The crew spent about 167 days in space. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. Radical Belonging, new autism-friendly faith formation resources are out. Meet the deacon behind them. And Pope Leo offers words of comfort to families affected by the deadly Gran Montaña fire. A meeting at the Vatican, Pope Leo XIV offered his reassurance to family members of those killed or injured by the tragic fire that struck Gran Montaña, Switzerland on January 1st. The Pope said he was deeply moved to meet with the families, sharing with them that the faith that dwells within us illuminates the darkest and most painful moments of our lives with an irreplaceable light. The Holy Father also reminded families that Christ is close to them and accompanies them. So far, Swiss police have reported at least 40 people died and 119 others were injured. The Archdiocese of Birmingham has released two new religious education guides that are autism-friendly. Both resources were written to support teachers and catechists who lack a background in special needs education. Deacon Mark Payne, a deacon with autism, penned the resources after years of experience in special education and service to the church. Called by name and Radical Belonging, provide adaptive lessons to create more inclusive faith formation for those with special needs. Although it's difficult to measure how many Catholics have special needs, about 79% of U.S. pastors know parishioners that have a sensory disability. Deacon Mark Payne himself joins me now. He is a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Birmingham and the writer of these resources. Deacon, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you today.
So first, can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you decided to write these resources?
Well, as you've already said, Veronica, I have a background in special education. I was a teacher for 30 years. A lot of that time was spent in special educational needs and helping children and families of children with special educational needs. Right from when I was a student, I've been involved in voluntary work with the church with people with special needs. And as you've already said, I am autistic. I was diagnosed in my mid-40s. The reason why I wrote it is because I recognized that there was nothing like this, at least in the UK. I've encountered many young people and their families who tragically have been unable to access the sacraments due to the fact there hasn't been a sacramental preparation program that addresses their needs. And I regard this as an injustice. When I talk about radical belonging and radical inclusion, I see the inclusion of people with special needs as intrinsic to the mission of the church. And if we are not engaging in different ways and adapting our methods in different ways to address the needs of people with a neurodivergence or who are nonverbal, then we are failing. We are failing to be the church we should be. And I think also I would stress we're missing out on the gifts those people bring. I think too often we have this idea that disability is something that is a tragedy or it's something that we pray for. It's a prayer intention. And what I try to do in my whole diaconal ministry is overcome that. I think it's important that people with neurodivergence, people with disabilities, people with special needs, and as you've already said, Veronica, there are many within the church, feel that they are full and equal members of the church. in my writing, I often talk about being an image and likeness of God. I mean, the imago Deo, the idea that somebody with disability is equally an image of God, a loved and perfect creation of God.
What's been
a
the
lot res- of the? Oh, sorry.
No, just what's been the response to your resources? And by any chance, do you happen to know if the Vatican is aware of what you've been writing?
I've absolutely no idea if the Vatican are aware. If I get some Swiss guards turn up at the door or something. But the response has been very, very good. I'm not a professional writer. I'm not a professional theologian. I'm not an expert. I'm just a dad of two children with autism, somebody who's worked in special needs. And I've been quite amazed by the response I've received from some very, very kind of high profile erudite figures within the kind of Catholic world. Quite humbling. The most important thing to me is, though, that I've had parents already coming to me asking me questions. I had an email this morning from a mom who wanted to know how to use one of the resources with her own children. And that's what matters to me. I'm not really interested in being recognized by the Vatican or anybody else. If I can, in my limited way, help some people, that's why I've done this.
And it could certainly be fascinating if it is rolled out on a larger scale. Deacon Mark Payne, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a mosaic masterpiece. We have an inside look at the Pope's new mosaic portrait ahead of its installation. In the Basilica of St. Paul, outside the walls in Rome, a mosaic portrait of every pope is on display. There you can see the unbroken line of supreme pontiffs all the way back to St. Peter himself. Today, the mosaic of Pope Leo XIV was brought to the Basilica for installation. EWTN News Vatican journalist Magdalena Walensky-Reedy takes us there.
It took more than 2 months of meticulous work to complete the mosaic portrait of Pope Leo XIV. The tondo has a diameter of more than 4 feet and weighs more than 300 pounds. The artistic process began with a painted sketch by the maestro Rudolfo Papa. It has just been presented to the Holy Father, who did not hide his appreciation.
Before creating the painting, a series of drafts were presented to the Holy Father. He then selected the initial sketch, and from that sketch the artist went on to create an oil painting of the same dimensions as a mosaic.
As soon as the painting was completed, the execution of the work on the mosaic on a metal tray began. 15,000 tiny mosaic tessere, or squares, made of glass enamel, were applied using a special oil-based mastic.
It is the same material that has been used for centuries in the tradition of the Vatican Mosaic Studio, the very same mastic that was used to set the original mosaics in St. Peter's Basilica.
The image of the Pope, the product of the efforts of a three-member team, is an almost perfect likeness of the original figure, faithfully capturing even the expression of his face.
An enormous number of enameled tessere were used, precisely because even in the face alone, there are hundreds of shades of flesh tones that were used to replicate the Holy Father's complexion.
The mosaic portrait will be installed at the Papal Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. There it will rest alongside the portraits of all 266 other popes, beginning with St. Peter.
The tradition of placing papal portraits here in this basilica dates back centuries, with first of them reaching at least the 5th century and the pontificate of Leo the Great.
It was delivered this morning by members of the Vatican technical staff, and our EWTN team had the exclusive opportunity to go behind the scenes and witness the full logistical and engineering challenge.
When the mosaic is lifted to a height of 43 feet and set into the roundel, that part clearly is not up to us. However, we follow the final phase of the installation of the mosaic onto the wall, the securing of the portrait, which is, in a sense, the very last step of this entire journey.
percorso.
The inauguration will take place during Vespers on the occasion of the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul on the afternoon of January 25th. The Pope will bless the portrait, and from that moment it will become the only illuminated papal mosaic in the Basilica of St. Paul, symbolizing the reign of the current Holy Father, Leo XIV. In Rome, Magdalena Wolinska-Riedi, EWTN News Nightly.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.